The Song of Roland stands as the crown jewel of medieval French literature, a powerful epic that transformed a minor historical skirmish into one of the most influential literary works of Western civilization. Composed around 1100 AD by an unknown poet, this masterpiece has captivated readers for nearly a millennium with its portrayal of heroic sacrifice, treacherous betrayal, and divine retribution. What makes this work particularly fascinating is how it reimagines a relatively minor historical event, the 778 ambush of Charlemagne's rearguard by Basque mountaineers, into a grand cosmic struggle between Christianity and Islam that resonated deeply during the First Crusade era. The poem's influence extends far beyond literature. It helped shape the very concept of chivalry and feudal loyalty that would define European culture for centuries. Even today, Roland's refusal to blow his horn until it was too late serves as a powerful metaphor for pride before the fall, a theme that continues to appear in everything from Shakespeare to modern superhero films. The Song of Roland grows from a small historical incident into a sweeping narrative of mythic proportions that would reshape medieval literature and cultural identity. In August 778, Charlemagne's rearguard was ambushed in the Pyrenees at Roncevaux Pass by local Basque warriors, resulting in the death of Hrodland, Count of the March of Brittany. This seemingly minor military setback, barely mentioned in contemporary chronicles, would undergo a remarkable metamorphosis through centuries of oral tradition, eventually emerging as France's national epic and a cornerstone of medieval literature. The anonymous poet brilliantly transforms this border skirmish into an existential clash between Christianity and Islam, reflecting the cultural anxieties and martial spirit of the Crusader era. Charlemagne appears not as the 36-year-old king he actually was, but as a 200-year-old emperor of mythic stature, blessed with divine wisdom and supernatural longevity. The Basque attackers become Saracens, representatives of a religious and cultural threat that resonated powerfully with audiences during the First Crusade. The historical Hrodland becomes Roland, the perfect embodiment of feudal loyalty and martial prowess, whose tragic death would echo through centuries of European literature. The poem's transformation of history reflects the medieval practice of translatio, the reimagining of historical events through contemporary, cultural, and political lenses. The poet infuses the narrative with feudal values not as abstract principles, but as a comprehensive worldview that structures every aspect of society. The poem presents feudalism as a sacred covenant connecting man to master and master to God, a system of responsibility, duty, and justice that gives meaning to sacrifice. When Roland refuses to blow his olifant horn to summon help, preferring death to dishonor, he embodies this feudal ideal in its purest form. His relationship with Oliver, his companion in arms, illustrates the complex bonds of loyalty that defined medieval warrior society. The poem's structure masterfully reinforces its thematic power through sophisticated literary techniques. Arranged in nearly 300 lessees, stanzas of varying length linked by assonance or rhyme, it achieves a rhythmic intensity that would have been heightened when performed by jongleurs for noble audiences. These professional performers would emphasize dramatic moments through vocal modulation and gesture, bringing the epic to life in great halls across medieval Europe. The technique of laissez-similaire, the repetition of key scenes with slight variations, creates a haunting echo effect that amplifies emotional impact. Despite its relative simplicity of language, the poem achieves epic grandeur through its portrayal of heroic deeds, clashing armies, and divine intervention in human affairs. Supernatural elements, such as angels bearing Roland's soul to paradise and God stopping the sun in its course, elevate the narrative from historical chronicle to sacred myth. The poem's influence extended far beyond its immediate cultural context, inspiring numerous adaptations and translations throughout medieval Europe. Its themes of loyalty, sacrifice, and religious conviction resonated across linguistic and cultural boundaries, making it a foundational text of European chivalric literature.
The epic's central conflict emerges from a deadly mixture of personal resentment and political intrigue. After 7 years of successful conquest in Spain, Charlemagne has subdued all territories except Saragossa, ruled by the pagan king Marsale. Facing inevitable defeat, Marsale devises a cunning strategy: send false promises of submission and conversion to Christianity, along with lavish gifts, to convince Charlemagne to withdraw to France. This diplomatic mission requires a brave ambassador to deliver the message to Marsale, a role that becomes the catalyst for tragedy. When Roland nominates his stepfather, Ganelon, for this dangerous task, what might seem a gesture of respect ignites a powder keg of resentment. Ganelon interprets the nomination as a deliberate attempt to place him in mortal danger, and his fury is immediate and visceral. "Thou thinkest here the glove will fall out of this hand of mine, even as the staff of office fell erewhile out of thine," he bitterly tells Roland, referencing an earlier moment when Ganelon had dropped the emperor's staff, a symbolic humiliation. This pivotal scene reveals the personal animosities festering beneath the surface of Charlemagne's court. Ganelon's public humiliation transforms into deadly resolve as he rides to Saragossa, not merely as the emperor's messenger, but as an architect of vengeance. The poet masterfully portrays Ganelon's psychological transformation from insulted nobleman to committed traitor through his conversation with the Saracen emissary Blantyndrin. As they ride together, Ganelon's complaints about Roland's pride evolve into active conspiracy. The treachery unfolds with chilling precision at Marsale's court. Initially threatened with death, Ganelon displays remarkable courage, drawing his sword and backing against a pine tree, ready to sell his life dearly. This moment of bravery makes his subsequent betrayal all the more shocking. When offered wealth and power, Ganelon's resistance crumbles. He devises a plan to ensure Roland commands the rear guard during Charlemagne's withdrawal, positioning him for ambush by Marsale's forces. What makes this betrayal particularly devastating is how it corrupts the feudal bond that forms the poem's moral foundation. When Ganelon swears upon the holy relics in his sword Murglass hilt to carry out his treachery, he perverts the very oath-taking that should secure loyalty. The poet shows how personal grievance can poison the sacred relationships that sustain society, setting the stage for the tragedy to come. The heart of the epic unfolds at Roncevaux Pass, where Roland's extraordinary courage is matched only by his fatal pride. As Charlemagne's army departs for France, Roland commands the rearguard with his closest companion Olivier and Archbishop Turpin. When the massive Saracen force appears on the horizon, Olivier immediately recognizes the peril and urges Roland to blow his horn, the Olifant, to recall Charlemagne's main force. Roland's refusal reveals the complex nature of medieval honor. "It would dishonor me in France to call for help against mere paynims," he declares. "I'd rather die than bring shame upon my parents or France." This exchange between Roland and Olivier crystallizes the tension between courage and wisdom that drives the narrative forward. Three times Olivier pleads with Roland to sound the horn, and three times Roland refuses, declaring that God and his angels would be displeased if France lost honor through his fear. The poet brilliantly contrasts the two companions. Roland is proud, while Olivier is wise, both gallant men who, once mounted and armed, will never flee battle. This distinction becomes crucial to understanding the tragedy. Roland's courage is beyond question, but his pride blinds him to tactical reality. Only when the battle is irretrievably lost does he finally consent to blow the horn, too late to save his men, but ensuring Charlemagne will return to avenge them. The battle scenes themselves are masterpieces of medieval epic poetry. The poet alternates between panoramic views of clashing armies and intimate portraits of individual combat. When Roland finally draws his sword Durendal, the descriptions become almost supernatural in their intensity. Roland fights fiercely until his lance breaks after 15 strokes. Drawing Durendal, he charges Cornabel, cleaving through helmet, hair, eyes, hauberk, body, saddle, and horse in one mighty stroke. These hyperbolic descriptions serve not merely as entertainment, but as illustrations of Roland's superhuman valor. As the battle progresses and the French forces dwindle, the emotional register shifts from martial glory to profound tragedy. The death of Olivier, struck from behind by the Algalif spear, leads to one of the poem's most moving scenes. Blinded by blood loss, Olivier unwittingly strikes his friend Roland before recognizing his error. Their reconciliation, Roland forgives him before our God on high, and the beloved companions bow their heads to each other in farewell, captures the deep bonds of brotherhood that transcend even the chaos of battle. The death of Roland stands as one of the most powerful scenes in medieval literature, transforming military defeat into spiritual triumph. Mortally wounded and the last survivor of his company, Roland struggles to a marble stone beneath a pine tree, determined that his legendary sword Durendal should not fall into pagan hands. This iconic moment, set against the backdrop of Roncevaux Pass in the Pyrenees, represents the culmination of both personal honor and Christian devotion. In a scene of extraordinary physical and emotional intensity, Roland repeatedly strikes the stone with Durendal, attempting to break the blade rather than let it be captured. The sword remains intact, a miracle that prompts Roland to recite the holy relics contained within its golden pommel. St. Peter's tooth, St. Basil's blood, St. Denis's hair, and part of the Virgin's vesture. This catalog transforms the sword from mere weapon to sacred relic, linking Roland's martial prowess to divine purpose. The unbreakable nature of Durendal mirrors Roland's own unbreakable spirit and faith, while each strike against the stone represents his desperate determination to protect not just a weapon, but the sacred heritage it embodies. The poet skillfully interweaves Roland's physical suffering with spiritual elevation through masterful sensory detail. Blood seeps from Roland's temples, his vision dims, yet his spiritual awareness heightens. As death approaches, Roland places himself facing toward Spain, ensuring that Charlemagne will find him as a conqueror who died facing his enemies, a gesture rich in both military pride and symbolic meaning. He offers his right-hand glove to heaven, a feudal gesture acknowledging God as his ultimate lord. This moment brilliantly recasts the feudal relationship in cosmic terms. Roland's death becomes not just a warrior's end, but a vassal's final act of submission to divine authority. The glove, traditionally offered to an earthly lord, now extends beyond temporal power to spiritual sovereignty. The supernatural dimension becomes explicit as angels descend to receive Roland's soul. God sends cherubim, Saint Michael of the Peril of the Sea, and Gabriel to bear Roland's soul to paradise. This divine reception confirms that Roland's sacrifice, despite its roots in pride, has been redeemed through suffering and faith. The presence of these specific angels, particularly Saint Michael, patron of warriors, and Gabriel, God's messenger, emphasizes both the martial and spiritual aspects of Roland's character. The poet thus transforms military catastrophe into spiritual victory, a powerful message for medieval audiences familiar with the uncertainties of war and the promise of divine redemption. What makes this scene particularly affecting is how it balances the intimate and the cosmic. Roland's personal memories of sweet France, his dear kindred, and Charlemagne who raised him humanize the hero in his final moments. These touching remembrances reveal the man beneath the warrior's exterior, someone who loved, remembered, and felt deeply. Yet simultaneously, his death triggers supernatural signs across France. Tempests shake the earth from St. Michael's Mount to Cologne. Earthquakes split ancient walls, and darkness descends at noon, nature itself mourning the fallen hero. This fusion of personal loss and cosmic significance elevates Roland's death from mere tragedy to martyrdom, creating a moment where heaven and earth meet in acknowledgement of a hero's passing. The epic scope expands dramatically after Roland's death as Charlemagne returns to avenge his fallen warriors. Upon discovering the massacre at Roncevaux, the emperor's grief manifests in deeply personal and physical ways. "Where art thou, fair my nephew?" he cries, tearing his beard in anguish, a gesture that appears repeatedly in medieval literature to signify profound masculine grief. The sight of Roland's body, stretched out facing Spain with his shattered olifant and sword beside him, drives Charlemagne to swoon multiple times. His knights must support him as he laments not only his beloved nephew, but also the flower of French chivalry lying dead among the thorns and briars of the mountain pass. The poet masterfully weaves supernatural elements throughout the vengeance sequence to emphasize the cosmic significance of Charlemagne's retribution. When twilight threatens to halt the pursuit of the fleeing Saracens, the emperor kneels in the blood-stained field and offers an impassioned prayer. God responds with a spectacular miracle, freezing the sun in the sky, a direct parallel to Joshua's biblical victory over the Amorites. This divine intervention transforms the pursuit from mere military strategy into holy warfare, with nature itself bending to accommodate God's chosen warrior. The Franks overtake the fleeing Paynims at the Ebro River, where the enemy's fate mirrors that of Pharaoh's army in Exodus. Their heavy armor, once a symbol of martial pride, becomes their doom as they sink beneath the waters. The arrival of Balagant, the ancient emir of Babylon, elevates the conflict to new heights. Described as having outlived Homer and Virgil, Balagant embodies not just Islamic military might, but also the accumulated wisdom and power of the pagan world. His massive reinforcement army includes warriors from 30 kingdoms, representing the full might of the non-Christian world. The poet details exotic troops from Nubia, Persia, and lands beyond the known world, creating a sense of Christianity facing a global threat. The climactic battle between Charlemagne and Balagant transcends personal combat to become a clash of civilizations. Their pre-battle exchange reveals the ideological stakes. Balagant offers life if Charlemagne becomes his vassal, while the emperor counters with promises of salvation through baptism. The duel itself unfolds with cosmic significance. Their shields splinter, their armor fails, and blood flows freely. When Balagant's sword cleaves through Charlemagne's helmet and draws blood from his head, the moment seems to herald Christianity's defeat. However, Saint Gabriel's intervention, "What dost thou, King most mighty," transforms the emperor's physical weakness into spiritual strength. The angel's presence confirms divine approval of Charlemagne's violence, and his final blow splits Balagant's head to the teeth, symbolically crushing paganism itself. This elaborate divine intervention framework serves multiple purposes. It legitimizes the violence as holy warfare, presents Charlemagne as God's earthly champion, and frames military conquest as spiritual triumph. The poet carefully constructs these supernatural elements to demonstrate that righteous violence in service of Christianity receives not just heavenly approval, but active divine support. Through this lens, Charlemagne emerges not merely a political ruler seeking revenge, but as an instrument of divine will, his sword arm guided by angels in the eternal struggle against infidels. The epic concludes not on the battlefield, but in the courtroom, as Charlemagne seeks justice for Roland's death through the trial of Ganelon. This shift from martial to legal resolution reflects the poem's sophisticated understanding of how society must process violence and betrayal through legitimate institutions. The trial scene reveals the complex social and familial bonds that complicate simple justice. Ganelon defends himself not by denying his actions, but by reframing them. "I admit desiring Roland's death for personal wrongs, but deny treason." This distinction between personal vengeance and treason against the state forces the court to confront difficult questions about loyalty and legitimate grievance within the feudal system. The trial's resolution through judicial combat, where champions fight as God's instruments to reveal truth, demonstrates medieval belief in divine justice manifesting through human institutions. When Thierry, physically outmatched by Ganelon's champion Pinabel, nevertheless triumphs, the Franks interpret this as divine confirmation of Ganelon's guilt. The Franks cry out that God has performed a miracle. Ganelon's execution is described in unflinching detail. They bind his limbs to four swift stallions. His body is horrifically torn apart, his blood drenching the green grass. This graphic punishment serves not merely as retribution, but as public restoration of the moral order. Significantly, Ganelon's 30 kinsmen who supported him are also hanged, emphasizing the collective nature of feudal justice. The poet explicitly states the moral, "Thus perishes the mighty traitor, proving that treachery shall never boast in its wrong." The poem balances this harsh justice with moments of reconciliation and transformation. The baptism of Queen Bramimonde, Marseille's widow, represents the possibility of spiritual redemption even after bitter conflict. Renamed Juliana, her conversion symbolizes the ultimate triumph of Christianity, not through violence but through grace. Yet, the epic refuses simple closure. In its final lines, the exhausted Charlemagne receives a new divine command through the angel Gabriel. He must march to Libya to aid another Christian king against pagan forces. The emperor pulls his beard and weeps at this endless call to battle. This poignant conclusion suggests that the struggle between good and evil, Christianity and paganism, continues without end. Each victory merely the prelude to another test of faith and courage. The Song of Roland transcends its status as mere literature to become a foundational text in medieval European culture. Its influence extended far beyond entertainment, helping to shape concepts of chivalry, national identity, and religious conflict that would define European civilization for centuries. The poem's portrayal of ideal knighthood established a template for chivalric behavior that would be elaborated in later romances and conduct manuals. Roland's absolute loyalty to his lord, his martial prowess, and his willingness to sacrifice himself rather than compromise his honor embodied virtues that medieval nobility aspired to emulate. Even Roland's flaws, particularly his pride, served as cautionary elements within this chivalric code, warning knights that courage without wisdom could lead to disaster. As one of the earliest and greatest vernacular epics, the Song of Roland played a crucial role in establishing French as a literary language and France as a cultural entity. By celebrating Charlemagne as a specifically French hero, despite his historical identity as a Frank, the poem helped forge a sense of national identity at a time when such concepts were just emerging. The repeated references to sweet France throughout the text reflect this nascent nationalism, linking territory, people, and values into a coherent whole worth dying for. Perhaps most significantly, the poem's stark division between Christians and Saracens both reflected and reinforced medieval Europe's understanding of its relationship with the Islamic world. Composed during the First Crusade era, the poem's portrayal of religious conflict as an existential struggle sanctioned by divine authority provided powerful ideological support for crusading. Though historically inaccurate in its portrayal of Islam, the poem's pagans worship Apollo and other classical deities alongside Mahound. This simplification served to justify military action against religious others. Yet, for all its martial values, the Song of Roland also contains surprising moments of empathy and nuance. The poet occasionally grants dignity and courage to Saracen warriors, acknowledging their prowess even while condemning their faith. This tension between demonizing the enemy and recognizing their humanity reflects the complex reality of medieval cross-cultural encounters, which included not just warfare, but also trade, intellectual exchange, and occasional alliances. The enduring power of the Song of Roland lies in how it transforms a specific historical moment into a timeless meditation on fundamental human values. Though embedded in medieval feudal culture, its exploration of loyalty, betrayal, pride, and sacrifice continues to resonate across centuries and cultures. At its core, the poem asks what we owe to those who command our allegiance, whether lords, nations, or ideals. Roland's absolute commitment to Charlemagne and France represents one answer, while Ganelon's betrayal offers a dark counterpoint. The tension between personal grievance and collective duty that drives Ganelon's treachery remains relevant in any society that demands sacrifice from its members. The poem also confronts us with the complex relationship between pride and honor. Roland's refusal to blow his horn stems from a noble desire to protect his reputation and fulfill his duty. Yet this same pride leads to catastrophe. This paradox, that our greatest virtues can become our fatal flaws when taken to extremes, offers a psychological insight that Shakespeare would later explore in his tragic Heroes. Perhaps most powerfully, the Song of Roland examines how societies make meaning from sacrifice and defeat. Roland's death, though resulting from tactical error, is transfigured through the poem into meaningful martyrdom. This transformation reflects humanity's persistent need to find purpose in suffering and loss, particularly in the context of war. When Charlemagne returns to avenge his fallen warriors, he enacts a ritual of redemption that converts military disaster into spiritual triumph, a pattern repeated countless times throughout human history. The poem's final image of the weary Charlemagne, commanded by God to continue fighting despite his grief, captures the exhausting permanence of moral struggle. There is no final victory, only continued vigilance and sacrifice. This recognition of life as ongoing ethical engagement, rather than a problem to be solved once and for all, gives the Song of Roland a philosophical depth that transcends its medieval origins. In an age of moral relativism and shifting loyalties, this ancient poem's unflinching commitment to values greater than self-preservation challenges us to consider what principles we would die to defend. Whether we share Roland's specific code of honor or not, his willingness to sacrifice everything for what he believes remains a powerful testament to the human capacity for transcending self-interest in service of higher ideals.